Hello and welcome to the Doula Tribe podcast. I'm Tess and I'm from the Nurture Doula Tribe. I'm a postpartum doula, a mother, and I'm Irish. We will be focusing on mothers, families, birth, parenting, and the postpartum period. I'll be diving into lots of topics around raising children. I want to speak to inspiring people and I want you to learn something. So make sure you tune in. Find me on Instagram and subscribe to this podcast. See you soon. Okay, welcome to the Doula Tribe podcast. Today we have a very special guest, a local naturopath, Phil Chua. And I have connected with Phil a few times in different social circles and on Instagram. And I know your wife, Emma, from Playgroup. So I'm very excited to have you here today because I know you're also a fellow home birth advocate.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Happy to come and share and have a chat to you. It's been looking forward to this for a little while now.
Yes, we've had to reschedule a few times, so thank you for being understanding. So tell me a little bit about yourself and you know, how you got into this field of work. I'm really interested in it.
Well, through school I was always kind of looking at ways, because like the key things I was kind of looking at when I was doing my BC at school was I loved the sciencey stuff, so all the biology and the chemistry, you know, left brain male stuff. And then, but I also really liked home eco. So I did home eco all the way through middle school and high school and did it as a BC subject, so food technology. So loved learning all about the ins and the outs about, you know, how food works and what it tastes like and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, surely there's got to be a way that I can marry these two together and get the sciencey, chemistry, biological side of things and the food together. And well, I was actually looking at nutrition and dietetics out of school and always apply the ENDS test. And what do these people do on a day-to-day basis? And looked at some dietetic stuff and it just really wasn't for me. And I really like talking to people and individualizing things to where they're at, as opposed to just kind of having general guidelines that I didn't make up. I'd been seeing a naturopath since I was a little tacker all the way through and did some clinic hours with her. And that was, you know, amazing, because you can, you know, what you talk about with different people is always different. And yeah, just kind of really inspired me towards that personalized medicine and how we can adapt things to different people based on kind of where they're at. And you know, everybody's in different spaces, even though you might, you know, do the same things, the rationale and the way you communicate that can be quite different. So yeah, really enjoy that ability to make things specific for people.
Yeah, awesome. And was there like a specific kind of catalyst that changed your trajectory in your life, or was it just like you went from VC into that straight away?
I did a gap year, so I worked at the school that I went to at Wanganui, and worked in the chemistry lab there actually. So was mixing chemicals and setting up experiments for kids. And about halfway through that year, I started doing some subjects for the degree. So I was just kind of just transitioned across into doing, it's like the introduction, all the stuff that you forget first year. but it was good, yeah, just to be able to kind of, I guess, kind of tiptoe into that a little bit without kind of committing all the way, to get a feel for what worked in terms of, you know, holistic healing models and all this sort of stuff that was, I guess, the foundation for where you start from.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. I'm so interested in it. I just couldn't go back to study. I couldn't think of anything worse.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking that the same. It's like, because this, I feel like this industry, there's always something new to learn. And yeah, I'm like, oh, it'd be great to do like acupuncture or something else like that. But it's like, it's just a completely different model. And it's like, and then it's like 3 or 4 years more studying. I'm like, just not right now.
Yeah. And not with kids, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So describe to me what your work is now and how that looks and what you're passionate about.
So over the years, I mean, in country practice, you see just about everything, and, you know, ranging from whatever you could possibly think of. Like I say to people, you could come to see a naturopath for anything you could go and see a GP for, you know, a cup. And then I'll follow that up with, if you've got a broken arm, go to the hospital, don't come and see me.
There's a place. There's a
There's a
place
place.
for
There's a
that.
place here, and I forgot what the question was. Too busy making a joke.
What you're passionate about, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So over that progression, I mean, you see different ranges of types of different conditions and things like that. And I love the ability to help people with their digestive health and work with that side of things. So over the years, I've looked for a range of different, I guess, modalities and diet models and these sorts of things that kind of integrate into what I do
Your
now.
thoughts on one pack.
So yeah, so seeing that range of different types of clients, I really enjoyed seeing more and more around digestive functions and being able to help and repair that side of things. I often say it's the gut is the gateway for healing from that perspective. So, I've been on a bit of a hunt to find models and diet protocols and things like this that work really well when it comes to healing, repairing the tummy and getting things happy and on track in that space. So what I do now is a bit of a combination of a few different things, depending on what's going on in front of me. But I do a lot of, as a gut practitioner, I do a lot of stuff in that gut healing perspective and being able to, I'm a food first. I'm a foodie. I love people getting people into the kitchen and cooking their own food because, that's where lifetime change comes from. People will only take a supplement for as long as the bottle lasts, but if you can teach them how to cook, they'll continue to do that. Hopefully, for a longer period of time. So, giving people the tools that they can use on a day to day that allows them to be healthy in the long run, which is great.
Amazing. And one thing come to mind there, when I worked at the foyer, you helped one of our students. I don't know if you remember him, and he was in the foyer kitchen, cooking bone broth.
So
And
good.
all the other students, like, because there's 40 of them live there, they were all like, what is going on? And then he was like drinking this jelly and the bone broth. And I just thought it was amazing that they were witnessing this young person take control of his health and really kind of like open up the doors to other young people. And they were so curious around it. And I just thought it was brilliant.
And that's how it works. You change one person and they change the community around them, which is so powerful.
And that's like a huge thing, isn't it? Food is massive, and
Absolutely. Yeah.
we're so uneducated around it, really, aren't we? Like, in a way, in the mainstream.
I don't know whether it's uneducated because there's no lack of information out there. I actually think that it gets to the point where we get overloaded with the information and then we just kind of throw our hands up in the air and go, well, I don't know anymore. And we just kind of default to whatever's most convenient. And most convenient isn't always about what's best for us from a nutritional perspective, but it's just one of those things that,
Sorry, one sec, my vacuum just started.
So we just default to what's most convenient. And I don't think that it's necessarily that it's uneducated because there's a plentiful amount of information out there that people can access. But I think the food industry benefits from people being confused about what actually healthful food looks like. So, and you see that, every new week there's a new fad diet and ex celebrities doing it or whatever. And people go, oh, give that a go. And it's interesting because I kind of think that there's always an element of truth in any diet model. And as much as there's some that I like more than others, there's often things I can go, okay, I can see that there would be some merit within that, I think. But ultimately, whether that is actually in line with what you need to do with your health at any given time is always the challenge. You've got to make sure that that connects.
There's so many elements to it, isn't there? Like, I remember seeing a naturopath and they were so good at like telling me everything holistically about what was impacting what. Like, as women, our cycles have a huge impact. And, there was just so much to it that I never heard from a GP before. And I was like, oh, this is way more involved, I found,
Well, you can't explain all of the female reproductive cycle in less than 5 minutes.
No.
It's just practically not possible.
No, we're very complex beings.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it definitely, there's lots of things, and like my body type, and I have like a certain blood type, and then there's like, my tr what maybe ancestrally I've carried from my own culture. Can you speak a little bit more about that side? Because I'm really interested. Like, I just cook what my mum cooked, and there's a lot of that is carries through. How does that look, and how do people kind of figure out what's traditionally being carried on in a good way, or is it an unhealthy way of cooking? How do they figure it out?
And I guess this is a challenge because many of these things take generations to show up. And you see this in today's kids, like our generation's kids, is that they'll probably be unwell with diseases that you wouldn't normally see until they're in their 20s and 30s, in their, younger than teenagers. And it's just because it's the, the test of time. And that's kind of what I use as some of that guiding principle, is that it's just about, okay, what has worked traditionally? Like, what did diets look like around the world before the industrialization of all the food networks and all of this happened? And although many different cultures thrived on different types of food, the key thing was around nutrient density. So there was always a focus on key nutrients, and these are the things that allow the body to function in an optimal way, basically. So to give you an example of that, like Eskimos, for example, live in a very different geographical location to people that live on coastal areas in Europe, who live in different locations to be a little bit like Indigenous people here in Australia. And yet they were all able to thrive over generations and be robust and strong and healthy. But obviously the food sources that they would have access to would be quite different based on their location. So there's other, like there's common links and threads through these cultures that would be different. And whether it was, small fish and things like that through some of those coastal regions, obviously a lot of insects and bugs and bits and pieces here in Australia, and other unique little bits and pieces, like raw milk and these sorts of things, or eggs. Like there's so many examples of cultures that have thrived in different areas of the world, but they all had that focus on really key specific nutrient dense foods that allow the body to be healthful. And the interesting thing is that a lot of these things are missing through standard diet models. So, and I talk a lot about vitamin A as a food source, as a food group. And vitamin A is just really, key for mental health and skin health and barrier function and hormonal health. And, the list goes on and on and on. But you look at a standard diet in today's realm, and it just doesn't exist in there, like at all. So, vitamin A from a conception perspective is important from a DNA protection perspective from the moment of conception. So from one cell to two cells, like all this sort of stuff is so vitally important. And our ancestors had periods of time in their preconception space where they eat a special diet, and through pregnancy and then, post-pregnancy lactation, all that side of things as well. So they recognize the importance of, loading the body with these specific nutrients pre-pregnancy and during pregnancy and post-pregnancy to recover things.
What are the kind of foods that someone listening can just go out and eat now with vitamin A?
So probably the main ones to think about is liver. Liver is the highest food source of vitamin A across the board. So there's a few different ways because people kind of will have a bit of a reaction to that viscerally sometimes about, oh, I'm not going to eat liver.
I remember my granny cooking it in the kitchen in Ireland. She would just get the steak and the liver, and get mostly liver because that was cheaper than steak, with gravy and onions. Like, it was a thing. We had it every time we went there, and I just, oh my God. I haven't
So
cooked it
it's
since.
since, yeah. And look, liver is one of those things that can be prepared in different ways. Like you talk to, I say, a lot of our grandparents' generations here in Australia, and it's very much soak it in salt water, thinly slice it, coat it in flour, and fry it in animal fat. And that's a way you can do it. Pate is kind of a bit more socially acceptable in today's circles, but I'll often also talk about like liver mince or mince offal mixes, which are much more accessible these days as well. So you can look at, getting them and just using them wherever you would use a mince meat, you use a liver mince mix. So through if you do bolognese or, lasagnas or meatloaves and things like that, you can just incorporate that into that. And yes, if you
Well,
know
it's funny, I feed my dog that.
and the dog's healthy, right?
Yeah, like he's on a raw food diet of offal and liver. It's so funny.
So, liver's really good. Eggs are really good if you get good quality eggs. And butter is kind of the other one that is fairly common. So they're the ones that I talk about sort of more than anything else as a starting point.
Yeah, and like you'll find a lot of the diets are recommending, the butters that are not butter.
All your margarines, I say the only place that you use margarine is to hold the bottom of your bin bag down. Like it's rubbish. Don't even
Yeah,
bother about it
it's
anymore.
saturated and yeah, it's terrible. And what's your take on ghee? Like, you like ghee?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so it's butter and ghee kind of get talked about in the same space for me. Ghee, for those of you who don't know, is just the clarified butter. So it's the oil component of butter with all the milk solids taken out. So for people that are a little bit sensitive to the dairy protein casein, is a little bit more tummy happy and friendly with those people. So yeah,
And
ghee
you
is
can buy it
absolutely.
at Coles now.
Yeah, it's around. It's definitely more accessible, but it's also really easy to make as well.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, that's awesome. And like with olive oil, like a lot of the Italians will cook with olive oil, because I'm marrying an Italian. Like, is it okay to do that, or is that not a, it's probably not beneficial, heat it up.
Yeah, so olive oil and a lot of your plant oils, I talk about as drizzle oils. So I would use them more in that space, and for a couple of reasons. So one of which is that you can't ever really guarantee the heat of the pan that you're cooking in. And most people probably don't get out their little heat gun to check the temperature of the pan before they put the oil in or any of that. But also the quality of olive oils varies quite a bit. And some of them will have a smoke point of 85 up to 130, 140, depending on what oil you get. So, there's a few variables in there, and the negative aspect of them being cooked and being rancid and when they oxidize, it causes a lot more damage in your body than benefit that you get from it. So, cooking with your animal fats, which is your butter and your ghee or your lard or your duck fat or your beef dripping or your tallow, like any of that sort of stuff is preferable because the smoke points are much higher, but they also carry the fat-soluble vitamins in them as well.
Yeah, I've just recently found tallow and I'm like so interested in it.
So good, isn't
Yes, I love tallow. For anyone who doesn't know, go and research tallow. So, because this is a podcast about birth and doula work.
it?
Tell me a little bit about your children and how they were born and yeah, how that looked.
So we're blessed to have two active, happy, healthy boys. Justin, our eldest, is 4 years old, and Franklin, our little tacker, is, I was in 19, nearly 20 months old now. So, they're happy, healthy, doing all their things. And I guess our birth story for both of them is a little bit different. We went through a private midwife for both of them. So my midwives, get the old tongue twister. And we actually ended up birthing in a northern hospital with Justin, our eldest, just because my wife went to 42 and 1. And when you're through programs like that, they're like, well, now you're in hospital. We don't really get a choice because it's deemed a higher risk for
And
whatever reason.
how does she feel about that when they said it?
Yeah, look, our plan was always to have a home birth for Justin. But but as I always say to my pregnant people, they're not my pregnant, but people that
Your
come to see me while
clients,
they're pregnant.
your patients.
Clients. But it's one of those things that you've got to be flexible with, and birth is one of those things that's extremely unpredictable. And you hear of so many stories of being really rigid around birth plans, and it can cause a lot of physical trauma and emotional trauma and that sort of stuff going forward. So we were okay. Our midwife had talked to us about what would happen if we got to 42 weeks in the weeks leading up to the time that it was 42 weeks. And it was interesting because we got down to Melbourne and they checked her in, and they checked the dilation, and she was like 6 or 7 centimeters dilated. So, like, had we have not gone to the hospital that day, it probably would have happened anyway. But like, you just don't know. But our experience as a hospital birth was actually, quite positive. Talking to a range of parents over the years, because we had two midwives, because the midwife that we were working with hadn't done her hours at the Northern enough to be able to be there by herself. So we had her and another midwife through the program for just us. So we had two midwives just for us, whereas I think it's normally 1 to 4, 1 to 5 in wards, depending on where you go. So we were very fortunate within that space to have an abundance of support and feel cared for and nurtured within that space. So yeah, that was amazing to have that experience through the hospital side of things. And our youngest, we birthed at home, which was, also kind of a different kind of feel and vibe and everything going on with that space. But yeah,
So
the
both the boys were born naturally.
yep,
Yep.
absolutely.
And there was no issues like with the position or.
Not that I can remember. There was some tearing and regular sort of stuff that happens, but nothing that caused any sort of complication going forward, which is fantastic.
Yeah, awesome. And how did you find the home birth? Because I had like this amazing transformational home birth, and then my partner was like, nah, didn't like he had a completely different experience to me.
It's same event, different experience. Yeah.
Yeah, you know the way perspective.
Yeah. Look, we both really we enjoyed it. Like the active labor was quite short, probably shorter than what we were expecting, which was fine. Because the active labor of the pushing side of things with Justin was also a short time frame in the scheme of things. It was just getting to the point. To get to that point, it took a little while, but yeah, it was great. And we planned water birth and all the things that we talk about. But I got the message a little bit late. It was actually quite funny. I was reading I think it's a John Eldridge book on like Wild at Heart. I don't know whether you've heard of that. So I was reading that book, and I'm just sitting in the back room, just all relaxed, reading this book, and I've just finished that book, and it's obviously got these other books that he's written in the background. I was like, oh, I'll just sit here and I'll order the next book. And then Emma's like, get the bath going now. I'll get
Birth
the
pool.
birth pool going. And it was happened before then. So it was, yeah, it has happened relatively quickly. But it's one of the things that they talk about through my midwives, or I guess most people in this space will talk about, is to do something that distracts you during labor. And Emma doesn't really like doing baking or anything in the kitchen, and so she I organized like a pre-packet mix of a brownie type mix to make because it makes her think and focus and things. So she was our midwife showed up, and she's like, oh, because Emma was in the kitchen mixing this thing up, which was quite good, I suppose. It's a literal birthday cake, and. So Maddie's just like, oh, okay, we're okay here. And she's obviously just doing her thing. So Emma puts these muffins in the oven, and then Franklin was born before the cakes
They
were
were,
cooked.
oh my gosh, funny.
So like, yeah, it was quite good.
So two land births.
Two land births, yep.
Yeah, lovely. And was Emma, really like, did she bring her baby up herself and have that experience where she was able to catch it?
No, sort of birth, and it
Handed it.
was yeah.
Yeah, no, it's such an amazing experience to be at home though in your natural environment and all the love hormones and the privacy that it really kind of gives you. I
Absolutely,
found,
yeah.
yeah. If you were going to have another one, would you have another home birth?
Oh, look, I'm open to the idea. That's not entirely my decision though. Like, and I guess this is the perspective from a male perspective. Like, we can want things, but at the end of the day, we're the support crew in that immediate time frame. So it's as much as we might have our ideas and expectations of what we want, and I guess mine will be different to perhaps most male partners. It's not necessarily about me, it's more about the mum within that space. So it would be whatever Emma would want.
Yeah, and where she feels safest.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Awesome. Good answer, Phil. How was your postpartum periods? Like, was it well supported? Like, do you have family around? Were they dropping food off? Did you feel like it was really well supported? Were they both different?
Both very different. So, Emma's parents live in interstate, so in Adelaide, and they'd planned in advance for Justin's birth when they were going to come over, which if she'd went to term would have been a couple of weeks after, which would have given us time to settle in and then get comfy and all that sort of stuff. But because he was full term plus a bit, they were over in a fairly immediate time frame after we'd gotten home. So it wasn't as settled as what it could have been. And I guess I felt that more probably than Emma did. Like, it's for her, it was probably great that she had her parents around. It did feel like a bit more work for me looking after two other adults as well as a small child.
It's a
So yeah,
lot.
it's a lot. But yeah, this with Franklin, it was great. We had our little bubble, and something that I encourage people to do if they can. Is everyone knows, but it's traditionally there was this very much a have a space for the baby and the mother, and just have that bond. And some cultures it's like 40 days
Yeah,
or
it
90
is.
days. Like it can be a lot longer. And some people go, oh, wouldn't you be going crazy? It's like, well, no, you're learning how to drive a new baby and all of that sort of thing. So
Yeah.
it's very different to what some people expect to have happen. And we've had, let me say, like we know people that have given birth recently and they were at the Chef Show within a week of giving birth. And I'm like, it's not my ideal way of
Yeah,
looking after a
no.
small person. So
Yeah. Whatever works, but
whatever works, yeah.
it's very different when you actually look into it and the rituals and the traditions around birth, how sacred it is, and when women actually want to look inwards and become a mother and cross over to this space, it's key to being left alone in that sacred space. And I just don't think in this culture we're taught enough about it. But yeah, we're starting to educate and change that pathway for people and, open it up a bit. Yeah.
It's just nice to know, like people don't even know that it's an option, I think.
I
And
know.
I think that's partly generational and partly the way that society is structured here in the West is there's often two parents working, so it's not practical for many households to have people home off work for that length of time, a month and a half, although it
Yeah.
would be probably a better outcome necessarily. I don't know, like everyone's family's different, but it's different to have, 4 days or 14 days or 2 weeks off and that sort of stuff, or even less than that for men sometimes because they're having time off pre-birth. Like it's really difficult to kind of explain that to people because like the internal male mechanism is like, I've got to go back to provider mode and get things going again.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
everyone's built differently.
Yeah. And look, there is parental leave out there for fathers, but it's often not accessed. So, people don't really know about it. It's not culturally accepted often. But yeah, hopefully it's changing. In Scandinavia, they do it really well. They get like a year off.
Yeah, I think it's 2 years total and that can be split between parents.
Amazing. We need
Yeah,
to get
so
there, don't we?
well, it's got its benefits. It's also got some downfalls with their systems over there. So
Yeah,
it's, yeah.
no, as everything.
Yeah.
As everything. So when you become a new mom, what often do you see as a practitioner in that space? Like, because I remember just feeling so depleted. My hair was just like a mess, like all the baby hairs. I had like low iron or something. I just remember not being very the first time, not being very prepared for my postpartum. Like, what do you see in that space, and how can women better prepare themselves?
So again, it's nutrient dense food and these sorts of things. So if you know what that looks like prior to giving birth, there's an element of that that can be prepared prior to giving birth. Like you can cook and freeze and all this sort of stuff so that you've got meals ready to go. Again, it's very much convenient and convenience focused, and people will just gravitate towards what is easy to prepare at any given time. And as a dad, I kind of go, well, I'm here to serve the mother in that initial time frame. So it's like they shouldn't have to think about making something or preparing food because they've got other priorities. In terms of rearing young children. So, whether that's that conversation with people around you in terms of like, here's three or four recipes of any of which I'm happy with, but these are the ones that I want. Again, because people will drop things off, but you kind of go, is that really what I want to be, put into my body? Because there's often a lot of in that immediate time frame, it's healing and repairing physically as well. If there's any birth trauma and things like that, that requires different nutrients to refill in your own nutritional buckets. And this is something that I talk about, particularly for people that have pregnancies or births close together. Is allowing space for the body to refill and replenish nutrient levels. So if you imagine like a bucket and you can go, okay, well, this is a vitamin A bucket or a vitamin B bucket or any mineral, magnesium, calcium, whatever it is, all the way down the line, like a birth will take out a portion of that, irrespective of what you want to have happen as a parent or a mother. Because from a generational perspective, the baby takes priority of nutrition. So it'll take what it needs. And it's hard work for the mum, particularly if they're having pregnancies close together and they haven't done the work to replenish their body from a nutritional perspective, because that makes a difference in terms of the health of the subsequent kids.
Yeah. And
So
what do you think is like an ideal time
yeah.
off from babies? Like, I would always say a year or two.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of different measures with this sort of stuff. Like I'd say many traditional cultures talked about 3 years between births. So it was considered shameful in some cultures if you gave birth to kids in a shorter space than 3 years,
Wow.
which I think is quite fascinating given the way that we look at kids being close together these days. It does depend on a few other factors in terms of, diet makes an impact in terms of how well you're actually supporting the body and getting those things back into your system. Because, particularly post second and third kid, if they're close together, you see a lot of postnatal depression, I find,
Yeah.
clinically, and a lot of that is nutrient deficiency in many cases. Understand that there has to be some element of replenishing the body to get it back to that point.
Yeah.
But that also happens, that will also, like that draw nutrition will still happen through breastfeeding periods. So everybody's journey with breastfeeding is different. And some people will choose not to, and that's also okay. But you would look, I would say 18 months, 2 years, depending on what you want to do for breastfeeding, and then a year after that. So the 3 year bracket, or 2.5 years, 3 years, 2 to 3 years, somewhere in there, is sensible from a body recovery perspective.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
depends on other factors as well. Like if your first pregnancy is, when you're 35 and you go, well, I want to have four kids or whatever it is, then it's like you got to get cracking. Like there's a certain element of time
There's a
within that as
window.
well. Yeah, there's a window, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, no,
So
that's true.
there's no set answer. Obviously,
Yeah.
if you're gonna aim to have kids closer together, then just be mindful that your body will recover better and you'll age better and more gracefully if you do the work through those times.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, there's so many fads now around supplements and powders and all sorts of things flashing up on Instagram at me. How do you sort through that mess? 'Cause it's so in your face. And like, I'm a huge advocate for Chinese herbs and herbalist tonics that you provide, but often the people will just order the celebrities powder that they're pushing with, a variety of different vitamins in there to help boost their immune system, say. I'll just give an example. How do you sort out what's actually real and what's not? And like, I hear the word bioavailable a lot. A lot of people don't know what that means. Like, can you tell me a bit about that?
There's kind of that's kind of like, can the body assimilate what you're actually taking in? So this can be different things in different spaces. So to give you a couple of examples, like any mineral in its natural form has to be bound to something in order for it to be not reactive. So as in, if you ever put magnesium in water, as in just a straight elemental magnesium, it's very reactive. So it has to be bound to something in order to make it suitable to ingest. And this can be many different things. So it can be bound to amino acid chelates, or it can be bound to citrates or oxides and different bits and pieces. So it will depend a little bit on the how well the body cleaves that apart and how well it absorbs it and these sorts of things. But the things that it's bound to will also have an action in your body, which we can't say, well, I'm taking it for that magnesium, but it's like, well, there's other things in there too. So there's different absorption profiles for those types of supplements, but also the forms of things like your B group vitamins makes a bit of a difference. And there's like activated B group vitamins and all sorts of other bits and pieces. And that's becomes more and more relevant if your body is not able to metabolize and process them in a way that's effective in terms of replenishing them and turning them over, because the body has its own ways of recycling them and making them new again. Talking about methylation and things like this. So if the body is not able to do that effectively, then it's often you get a more effective clinical dose with that if you give activated vitamins within that area. But again, like to answer your questions, like how do you know what I need to do? Like it's, I say, come and see somebody that knows what they're doing is probably the short answer.
Pretty much.
I mean, because in clinic here, I have some testing that I can do that really streamlines that. So I have some non-invasive testing that I've done on babies as young as 10 days old that can assess nutrient status and that sort of stuff is in terms of what the bodies need and require at any given time. So there's ways of shortcutting that. And yeah, anytime you see an ad on Instagram, you just go, well, this is $10 more or $15 or $20 more than probably what it actually costs to produce because the advertising cost goes into the total cost of the product. So yeah, just talk to somebody who knows what they're
Yeah,
doing.
and like if you try and read the back of them, it's impossible.
Yeah, it's a different language, I guess, compared to what you're doing. And the challenge is that even from a labeling perspective, they're only required, and Australia is horrendous for this sort of stuff, like they're required to put ingredients, but not excipients and not the quantities in many situations. So there'll be products that will have excipients that are don't agree with people, and that can cause other issues from a tummy perspective. So there's the whole kind of minefield around that, and that's quality of product and these sorts of things that becomes more of an issue. But as a practitioner within the space, you kind of go, okay, I can get access to better quality products probably than what you can get on Instagram. In fact, I'm fairly confident of that.
Absolutely. All right, love that. Thank you. So how can people connect and find with you? I'm actually just in my head going, I need to book in with Phil.
You can just Google me, Phil Chu Nashpath. Hopefully my Google algorithm is working well enough. But Facebook, Instagram, the other there's all the tubes, so to speak. So yeah, I've hopefully fairly easy to find online. So that's relatively good. But there's online booking, so you can do it. I've had people booking at like 11:30 at night. I was like, okay, this person's desperate.
And you
So
sit in active spine, don't you?
yeah, so I'm practicing from Active Spine Centre, which is in the Butter Factory
Yeah, in Chevron.
Cafe area. Yeah.
Cool. Easy to find then.
Absolutely. Central, easy to get to, lots of parking.
And so may like talk me through an appointment. I'm gonna book in tomorrow. What happens? I come in, what do you do? Like what's the first thing we do?
I'll say, hi, Jess, how you going? Yeah, so
Instructions over.
instructions over, yeah. So we'll obviously have a bit of a chat about what it is that you're here for. And then we'll do some testing. As I said, I've got some testing here that we can do that really helps to narrow things down, and also means that what we're doing is actually agreeing with your body as well.
Is
So
there a limit on the amount of things I can bring? Because GPs say that.
no, and I'm quite happy, and I much prefer it because like I like ha our health is a web, and I think people think about it as like one strain of a cobweb, if you like, and it's kind of like, okay, if I pull over here, it affects over here. But like in reality, our body is more web-like in nature. So everything affects everything. So it's kind of all cards on the table. I will, with my clinical knowledge, but also with what we find through testing, I always say it's a bit like a game of pickup sticks if you've ever seen or heard of that. There's always that one little stick in there that, like, if you get that stick out, the rest of the game becomes a lot easier. And that's often what health is like. You know, there's often those key things that if you address those, many of the other satellite things that are going on from a health perspective will improve. And you know, that's, you know, you get that benefit of experience of being like, okay, this is what's, you know, it's the cornerstone of what we need to work on right now. And although, yes, there's 15 or maybe not 15, maybe five, you know, a handful of things that you want
That's
to work on,
fair.
you know, we talk through that, and you know, I'll ask people, you know, what do you want to work on? Because what I think is most important as a practitioner and what you're coming in for might not necessarily line up, but we can adjust what we need to do so that everyone's happy.
Yeah, that's awesome. That sounds really good. All right, well, thank you. I really appreciate this chat because I think it's super important that, you know, women and families around shepherding are really well informed around this space. And yeah, I hope that you have a lot more success and beautiful future with your family. And thank you for chatting to me.
Okay, anytime.
All right. Welcome to the Doula Tribe podcast. Today we have Philip Chua. He's a naturopath. He has a decade of experience in clinical practice. He also has a special interest in supporting people improve their digestive health and has had extensive training in that space. He's a GAPS practitioner and he understands that food education is such an important step in being well, as the food we choose to eat every day is what heals and supports our bodies to thrive. So he works across whole families and as well as whole generations. And his wife and him have two wonderful boys who are 4 and 1. And he sees that being a dad is his most important job in life. He finds his work very empowering. And it means that once clients have learned what works for them, they can go out and be an example in the community. And he believes that people are healthier than they are able to make better choices for themselves and their communities. So, welcome, Phil.